There we go. Oh, I can hear myself. Must mean my mic was working. Good morning. So for who is this the first session of the day? A couple of guys. Well, you missed Francois' great interoperability session. So good morning to everybody. Welcome to the networking session. It's it is a link session, but still we're going to talk about networking. So, well, let's start off. Enterprise network requirements for Link. I think this is interesting stuff, right? It's one of the forgotten things when doing Link. Everybody's like, well, we're going to deploy Link, and it's going to work great because we did it for Exchange, right? Next finish, Exchange was done. And if there are Exchange engineers in this room, you can kill me later. That's fine. So we had the Exchange thing, next finish, it would work. Well, from a network perspective, and now, well, if Exchange worked well, why not get Link in and get Link working? So that almost never really worked out. So we have a good session about, well, I think it's a good session, about, well, enterprise network requirements when doing Link deployments. Hence the name. So the two points I want to talk about today. First, networking basics. So who has a network background in this room? See, a couple of guys. Truth is, most people that will be deploying Link have no networking background. They'll be able to distinguish a router from a switch, and they'll know the basics in networking, IP addressing, things like that. But you'll be talking to let's make a big heap of these people, the networking guys, who'll be throwing things like, well, we'll do 802.1 p tagging, and how does Link fit in there? And most people that don't have a networking background will say, well, we'll press next and it'll work. So I want to talk about that portion. So you can have, so we use this, we used to call this session, part of this session, having intelligent conversations with network engineers. So I stole some of that. And the second portion is, how does Link fit into that network? So what about QS? What about Link and VLANs? What about Link and bandwidth, which is a hot topic these days? And the key takeaway, discussion with networking people, how to talk to them, how to play nice with them, and how to make sure they start liking Link as well. So means we're going to start about a little bit networking review, a little background about networking, some QS basics, how about QS and Link, and how about network bandwidth and Link. So let me start about me. I'm Cornel Bonnens. I'm Dutch. I live in Houten, the Netherlands, and I've managed to capture most of the things that are important about the Netherlands in one picture. So yes, we have windmills, yes, we have tulips, and yes, we have rain. There we go. That's the three most important things about the Netherlands. So most people in the Netherlands that I know right now hate me because it's beautiful weather in Madrid and it's raining in the Netherlands. I'm a voice architect for the Communication Center of Excellence within MCS. I have my dear colleague, Mr. Binder, with me. We'll do more sessions this week about voicey stuff. I'm a certified master in Link 2010, certified solution master in 2013. Part of my job is to teach at Tech at Tech Ready, but also at our certified solution master training. That's me on the right. You can see when I point at the screen, right? So at the bottom right, that's me. You might have figured it out. I was at Disneyland, so I get to visit some cool places every now and then. And I had this thing on the right open, so I put in a portion of Star Wars Lego, which I started collecting, and every one of my colleagues makes fun of me for that, but still. And if you ever want to annoy me in any formal way, kburns@microsoft.com, you can ping me, you can IM me, call me, especially when I'm at Do Not Disturb, that's the best point to start video calls with me. So that's me. I also tend to walk around a lot, but since I spilled coffee on myself this morning, I'll try to not move away from the stage. I talk a bit fast, I know that. So I'm conscious of the fact that there are a lot of non-native English speakers in this room. So if you missed something, please ask me and I'll clarify. I know most of you are non-native English speaker. I'm not a non-native English speaker, which means I start making up English words. It's fine. So, networking review. Let's do a quick recap. Let's do a recap on networking terms that you'll be using when talking to the networking guys. So, we'll start off easy, right? So we have WANs and LANs, wide area networks, local area networks. The thing we care about are the wide area networks, the networks that connect our customer sites together. Local area network, well, gig to the desktop, that's sort of the standard right now. To be fair, if you have an issue to run link in your own LAN, your issue might be bigger. You might want to solve that first before looking at the WAN and link. Well, I think any product would start to fail at that point. Some of the layers, I'm not going to bore you with the OSI layer. The two layers that I'm going to touch on today, layer 2 and layer 3, the stuff that we mostly use, IP and just IP addressing and talking to each other, is layer 3. That's the thing we're interested in. That's the layer that Link likes. Layer 2, basically the Ethernet frames, it's what the internet is built on, what the network is built on. Some OSes, which is where it's important to make the distinction. We have a class of service, which is an old networking term, to describe a layer 2 classification mechanism, a priority mechanism. We have type of service, TOS, which is what we use at layer 3, which is something that Link can reference to. And we use DSCP markings, our differentiated services code points, to actually tag something and make sure something gets put in the right type of service. Now here's where the confusing thing comes from, because we used to use clause of service when the network started and when we started doing things like quality of service. All these different OSes are referred to as a class of service. So don't be fooled into thinking, oh, they're using class of service, that's a really old network. It's sort of a umbrella term. So the things we're most interested in is our type of service, this is high priority, medium priority, low priority, and the markings to mark that traffic to make sure it gets put in the right type of service. VPNs, virtual private networks, QS, quality of service. So, I'm going to touch more on that later on. To be clear, DSCP markings are not quality of service. They're a part of quality of service. Quality of service is basically making sure you get the best type of treatment for your sort of traffic. So, making sure voice gets as fast as possible from A to B can be considered to be done by quality of service. One of the mechanisms is queuing priority, setting diffserv tags, things like that. And the last vocabulary term today would be MPLS, multi-protocol label switching, or better known as the cloud. That's what the networking guys will call the cloud. It's always referenced in pictures as a nice cloud, hence the term. So what's an MPLS network? I really like this definition. It's a network. It's a layer 3 WAN. Means it's an IP level WAN. It's built by a service provider to sell bandwidth to many customers and could potentially guarantee a quality of service over that network. So apart from selling you the MPLS WAN, they could also sell you a 10% gold class or diamond class, things like that. The beauty of the MPLS WAN is it's any-to-any. So A to B doesn't mean it now has to traverse your data center. It can go directly from A to B. We allow separations, or you can call them VLAN, however you'd like to call them. between customers. So you have your own little private network over a large area network, a wide area network, and they could potentially provide you internet services inside your cloud. Usually when you're talking about your cloud with a network engineer, this would be the reference, the MPLS WAN. So what kind of WANs do we have? It's fairly safe to say that if your customer is talking about their WAN, they're talking about their MPLS cloud. Most customers at this point would have an MPLS cloud. Soon as you get into the more difficult customers, challenging customers, they probably have multiple MPLSs connected to each other based on calls in that specific region. And it sort of becomes a star network of multiple MPLS networks. But overall, safe to say, MPLS. So what about the internet? Well, it's a WAN. It's a big cloud. I can go reasonably any-to-any in an internet environment. The thing is, it's a public network. So the main difference between an MPLS WAN and your internet WAN at that point would be, if I send data from A to B, I have control over whether the packet reaches or not. I can put something in a gold clause or a diamond clause in a priority queue. If I put something on the internet, it might get there. It might not. That's where TCP/IP comes in. Two of the important terms that get mangled up quite a bit, IP VPNs and internet VPNs. What's the difference? Well, an IP VPN is a MPLS cloud. It's a connection between two networks or two routers or however VPN concentrators, whatever you'd like to use. But you're using it's built on top of a private layer tree. As soon as you go into an internet VPN, it's really, I bought an internet connection from a provider, and I'm now using an IP VPN on top of that. Which means that IP VPN, sure, you can do traffic prioritization. Internet VPN, well, we've just established, I put traffic on the internet, it might get there, might not, might get there within a reasonable amount of time. Traffic prioritization wouldn't do much for me. So with Link, once again, we like the MPLS WANs. We can have control over that. So we've talked about WANs and LANs. So what about Wi-Fi? Well, we now officially support Wi-Fi with Link. We had recommendations and we had help if you had Link 2010 and wanted to do Wi-Fi. At this point, we actually have certain Wi-Fi vendors like Aruba Networks that have certified their equipment or qualified their equipment for use with Link. We've made some white papers, and you can all download the presentation and find the links, because I'll be using way more links. And you can use that white paper to optimize any Wi-Fi network you currently have. It's not just for the Aruba Networks or for any of the other qualified vendors. It's basically recommendations for both enterprise networks, public networks, and home networks. So one of the things, if you're dealing a lot with remote users, people working from home, you can actually tell them, well, if you buy this router, this access point, that will get you the best experience over Wi-Fi for Link. So we've put quite a lot of effort in that. So now that's sort of the basics. So let's talk about some of the stuff that gets us in trouble, network impairments. And the three most important ones when we're talking about impairments are latency, jitter, and packet loss. And they affect our network and our performance in different kinds of ways. So let's start with latency. So latency is actually the delay that I would experience between point A and point B. So how do we measure this? Well, we use a value called round trip time, which means how long does it take to get from point A to point B back to point A. So if you look at your monitoring server, which should be your best friend, if you're doing anything with network, if you're deploying Link, make sure you get a monitoring server deployed as well. It's part of the front-end server, can be co-located with the front-end server. So you don't need extra servers at this point. Please deploy it. It will help you a lot. So some of the things it will show you. So I've tagged the values as long as the round trip time is below 200 milliseconds. We're not going to mark it. If it's over 200 milliseconds, we'll mark it yellow. And if it's over 500 milliseconds, we'll mark it red. So overall, our recommendations for round trip time would be 150 milliseconds is what we're aiming for under peak load. The thing is, we have to deal with this very annoying thing called distance. If I'm going from the Netherlands to Australia, I'm not going to get 150 milliseconds round trip time. It's not going to work. There's just too much distance between them. So yeah, I'll probably get 250. And even though it might be flagged as yellow, that's fine. There's nothing we can change about that. We can bring Australia closer to the Netherlands. I don't know if you want to, but it's kind of hard to do. So even though these values, because they impact the time it takes for my voice to travel all the way to Australia, we'd like this to be as low as possible. We can't always impact that. Okay, so the question is, so we're talking about voice and video, what about IM and presence? So I'll get back to you on that later on. In short is, in general, you wouldn't really care about delay for IM and presence. Because if I type a message and it's going to take half a second to get to the other side of the world, the one thing I would see in my link client is, person X is typing a message, and that would take half a second longer. So that doesn't really matter at that point. Okay, but we'll touch more on that later on. So this is really mostly aimed at voice and video. So the recap, these three values, try to keep it at 150 milliseconds. Keep in mind, you are dealing with geographical distances. You can't control those. And in the end, use your head. If I'm talking about a distance of Madrid to Barcelona, and I'm getting a round trip time of 150 milliseconds, sure, that falls within my that's great category. I would still think the network is bad. 150 milliseconds to get between two places reasonably close? No. That should be 40 or 50. So think about this, and this is just from the networking point of view, right? We report on the networking point of view. Because where stuff gets confusing is when we start talking about we like 250 milliseconds round trip time, but that's mouth to ear. So that's really when all the codecs are getting involved, the media stack, all that other stuff. So this is just a network layer. So the one statement we always make sure your network can handle a network-based round trip time of 150 milliseconds under peak load. Which brings us to jitter. So what's jitter? Jitter is actually the... So if we send a packet from A to B, it's not like there's this one train where everybody gets in and then the train continuously keeps running. The packet goes from A to B as fast as it can, as fast as the route or the switch or whatever is in between allows it to. So we might get burst, or we might get packets that packet B is there earlier than packet A. So we build a little buffer. And we might want to wait a few milliseconds for packet B to arrive, or sorry, packet A to arrive before we start playing packet B. So it's basically our little buffer we build. It's the amount of delay between packets to get a nice 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sequence instead of just start discarding packets. The more garbled your packets arrive, the more jitter I get, the higher my jitter buffer has to be, and this starts adding up to my delay, right? If I have 100 milliseconds latency between A and B, but I also need to have 20, I need to compensate for 20 milliseconds of jitter, and I actually have 120 milliseconds latency. So the values we like to use, less than 20 milliseconds is good. More than 30 milliseconds, tagged yellow in a monitoring server report. More than 45 milliseconds, very bad. As soon as you get a high jitter amount, we'll start dropping packets. Because there's going to be a point in which we'll say, well, we've got packet 2, 3, and 4. We're going to stop waiting for packet number 1. We'll just play packet number 2. That's fine if it happens once. If that keeps happening, we're losing a lot of packets now. Plus added latency. Which brings us to our packet loss rate. So when we're talking about packet loss, we're talking about both discarded packets because they can be garbled for any reason, and we're talking about packets that just never arrive. We prefer to use UDP in all of our voice and video traffic, which means that UDP is really the protocol in which you just send it and you'll hope it ever arrives. And if it doesn't arrive, we potentially don't really care. Because, well, TCP/IP is all about retransmits if something doesn't get there. Well, if I'm doing a voice conversation, we've talked about this jitter and this delay. If I'm doing a voice conversation, I've now had packet 2, 3, 4, and 5. Do I really care waiting 100 milliseconds for that packet 1 to arrive? No, I'm going to discard it. I'd rather have a little bit of choppiness in my call than really have a 2, 3, 4 second delay. We could do a perfect call with absolutely zero packet loss, but you'd have to wait 3 or 4 seconds before the call gets replayed. You'd really get this high delay. So we use UDP and we will get packet loss. If you get less than 3%, it's fine. I've seen your question. If you get less than 3%, it's fine. We're good with less than 3%. We have healing mechanisms, and we'll take a quick look at that. We have multiple mechanisms to cope for that. Essentially, we're good with 20% packet loss. The one thing with 20% packet loss is it has to be consistent. So packet 1 lost, 2, 3, 4, 5 there. Packet 6 lost, 7, 8, 9, 10 there. 20% packet loss, very predictable. It's something we can cope with forward error correction. Unfortunately, the internet doesn't work that way. Networks don't work that way. They're not nice. They're not going to say, ooh, Link likes to lose very consistent packets. Let's only lose every fifth packet. No, they're just going to drop stuff. Which means that it's unpredictable when stuff's going to get lost. So we'd like less than 3%. More than 5%, you will start hearing choppiness. You will start hearing loss of speech. Your voice will get robotic. We're trying to heal the packets. But you know these nice little curves you have in waveforms? We're just going to wing it, which means a curve will get a very straight, will become a straight line for us. So we can't really guess curves, but we can guess straight lines, which means you get a robotic voice. More than 10% is very bad for Link. We have a higher threshold for packet loss because of our healing mechanisms and the way RT Audio was designed. Keep in mind, based on the codec that you're using, your thresholds for packet loss may vary. G711, more than 3% packet loss, that won't be a nice conversation. RT Audio, 5% packet loss, it will sound way better. There's a reason for us to switch between G711 and RT Audio when you're doing a PSTN call if there's a high delay or a high packet loss. We can cope better. You had a question. So why am I only referring to audio signal and not video signal as well? So this would be true for both video and audio. Same for, by the way, same for the previous slides. These are true for both audio and video. The thing is, video handles packet loss differently. With video, you get like this, you get a super frame, which is your complete picture, and then you get updates to that picture. That's how video works. And packet loss gets treated differently. And I'll be at the booth at 12:45, the Link booth, and I'll be very happy to explain this in great detail. But the in essence, these thresholds are true for both video and audio. The way it's handled in the end is a bit different. We will always prefer audio over video, by the way. If we see more room for, if we see a finite amount of room, we will always prefer audio, make sure your audio is better, and your video is worse. So let's move into some of the QS basics. What about this whole quality of service? So we've talked a little bit about the latency. You can't really do much about geographical distance, but we can improve on how the way packets are routed. So what is quality of service? It's more than just marking a traffic clause with exploit forwarding or something like that. It's a combination of network technologies that help you prioritize certain traffic over other traffic. In essence, it will improve the user experience for both audio and video. So when is QoS needed? It's a difficult question. You would need it, as in stuff goes bad, if bandwidth is limited, or if there's a possibility of network congestion. That's when you would really need it. When should you implement it? Always. Simple as that. So we used to have so when we launched OCS R2, I don't know if some of you had watched that presentation with Gurdip Singh Pal. He actually came on stage and someone asked him, well, what about QoS and OCS at that point? He said, oh, you don't need QoS. Who needs QoS? Buy more bandwidth and everything will be fine. So we, at this point, we have some white papers, and our general recommendation is use QoS. There are very little deployments that do not require QoS. A 5-person deployment on a gigabit switch would qualify as a no QoS needed deployment. I'm thinking there wouldn't be that many of those deployments. You will almost always need QoS. So one of the things we've done is we've released this white paper. We're becoming more and more clear on how to implement QoS, why implement QoS, and how to do this effectively with Link. Our own IT department, responsible for over 100,000 enterprise voice seats within our production deployment, basically saying, well, as soon as we turned on QoS, everybody was way more happy. And I was part of that. I'm part of certain discussions with the QoS teams and the teams responsible for managing Link. It really helps us. It's please do. So I talked about this buy more bandwidth. Doesn't really work, right? Because even if I have a gig to desktop, or in this case, I have 100 Mbit WAN link for 500 users, which could be considered quite excessive for just 500 users. You'd more commonly see a 20 Mbit. If I'm just deploying a 15 meg antivirus update from a gig server, I actually have 10 minutes where my WAN link will be just full. So what about Link at that point? I have 100 Mbit. I bought more bandwidth. I did exactly what Microsoft told me to do. I bought more bandwidth. I've got way more bandwidth I would need. Still, my quality sucked. What can we do about this? So with QoS, our bottom line is, depending on your traffic, give it prioritization. Make sure Link voice, Link video, or any type of video or voice is prioritized over an antivirus update. So yeah, it's critical. Yeah, we need to get it there as soon as possible. But if it's there 1 minute late, 11 minutes instead of 10, and ensuring your video and audio still work great, I think that's worth it. So we have different QoS mechanisms that we can use. So I'm going to talk a little bit about queuing, because that's the most commonly used way of doing QoS. We also have shaping, congestion avoidance. We have some vendors here this week, like the people at Riverbed Technologies. I'm sure they can explain this way better than I can. but there are a lot of ways, but the most common way we see, the most common deployment we see at customers would be different queuing mechanisms. It's the way we base most of our recommendations on. Different ways to distinguish those traffic types with quality of service, based on ports, based on VLANs, based on 802.1 or COS tagging, DiffServe, type of service tagging, which is the one we always prefer, MPLS tags. We have a lot of different ways, and then I'm just leaving all the fingerprinting technologies and things like that out of the scope. So, very simplified, classification versus marking, very, very simple. I have a traffic. So when I mark traffic, I can then classify the traffic. Two different things. So I've marked my traffic as being voice. So I said, this is voice traffic. Please ensure this is handled in an expedited forewarning way. So in this example, you'll see EF being used for our VoIP traffic. You can see AF3 being used for our applications. So you start off with tagging the traffic. What's this kind of traffic? Voice, video, sharing. Is this perhaps a critical business app? And then before you put it on the WAN, on the left, the big pipe is a WAN representation. How should I handle this? Should I give this prioritization over everything? And that's what you commonly see the tags for. Expedited forewarning means low latency, low delay, low loss. Just takes precedence. So the main distinction, we type the traffic, classificate the traffic. As soon as we know what kind of traffic it is, we can prioritize or deprioritize, or we can actually do a quality of service on that traffic. Provide a quality service for that traffic. So looking at the layer 2 classification methods, we don't really use this. This is for legacy systems, how legacy systems used to do it. Right? You used to have voice VLANs. And you just say, well, I'll give this VLAN prioritization over everything else, which is fine, because you'd have a complete VLAN with all the voice traffic in it. It's easy. If it's in this VLAN, precedence over everything. Well, with Link, our primary phone is a soft phone. Yeah, putting a PC in a VLAN that gets precedence over everything, that's not going to happen. 802.1p traffic marking, it's same thing, layer 2 priority mechanisms. You now have to do funny tricks with your PC, different ports, and it's not going to happen. More of a reference slide, this is the stuff that's never going to happen with Link, in short. You might see VLAN tagging with IP phones. We've actually changed the statement. We're saying even if you have IP phones, don't use VLANs. Put them in your production network. Use DHCP or port-based tagging. Make sure that the traffic is classified, not the VLAN. Which brings to the things we do like. Port-based marking. So you can basically limit Link traffic to certain ports and tell them, well, if this is coming from port 51,999 up to or down to 51,500, or maybe even a smaller range, we need 20 ports per modality, mark this traffic as expedited forwarding. It's hard to set up. Well, hard to say. It requires a lot of due diligence and requires a lot of writing it down correctly and sticking to this to make this work. Our experience is that doesn't really happen all that much. So we need an easier way. Instead of configuring all my routers, all my switches, we want to do this easier. So what's an easier way? Just set a DHCP marking, which is something you can do with Link. Link can mark its traffic as being expedited forwarding, can mark its traffic as being assured forwarding 43, things like that. The one thing that sort of holds this back is I now have a PC that's capable of doing DHCP markings, which means there's always going to be this one guy in your company that really likes torrents and really wants to download quite quickly, and just found out if he downloads this one program and now starts taking all his torrent traffic with EF, his torrents go really fast. So while we recommend DSCP markings, while we like DSCP markings, what you'll see at most customers is a combination of the two. So it's a DSCP marking on a lockdown PC that doesn't allow for any other markings, combined with port-based markings. And you'll see centralized or WAN egress routers and ingress routers allowing only DSCP tagging from certain IP ranges and certain port ranges. So we don't do DSCP tagging on a router level at that point, based on port ranges. We'll actually do it on a PC level, which is easier to change, easier to maintain. And the only thing your ingress and egress points, your routers, would do at that point is actually allowing or stripping the DSCP markings. Stripping rogue markings, allowing true markings. So in short, how does DSCP queuing work at that point? It's not going to spend too much time. On the left, you'll see your train coming in of packets, all the packets converging, going into the queues. And now based on the classification, whether it's EF, AF, whatever, we now put them in different queues. And we'll make sure that Q1, if anything's in Q1, will stop processing anything in the other queues and make sure Q1 goes out. Only if Q1's empty, we'll stop processing Q2. And only if Q1 and 2 are empty, we'll go to Q3, etc., etc. Or a combination of the sorts. And this is where you see that combination. Unless you really like to spend days and days in a room with networking guys and talking about the different ways of queuing mechanisms and how you really like Link to be in a very specific queue and how their router should use that, I would stay away from these talks. These are not fun talks. If you're a Link engineer or a Link architect or whatever you are, chances are they'll know more about this and they'll trick you into wrong answers. Saying voice traffic should be expedited full warning is enough. Don't get into these conversations. They're difficult, they require a lot of networking knowledge, and in the end, the customer in general knows their network better than you do and how the network would respond to traffic. It's a difficult conversation to have. I know about networking. I don't like these conversations. I'll just go, yes, EF. Where's the coffee? The one thing we do keep seeing when we implement this is just because QS is enabled in site A and B doesn't mean it's enabled in the same way, which is fun. So we've had multiple customers where when we start implementing Link and we saw some bad calls and we started digging into this and do network sniffing and some network testing, we found out things like video calls, which were getting a DSCP tag of 36 and we're getting an AF clause assigned to them. When they went out, they were treated as assured forwarding traffic, because that's what the tag 36 had. But the different domain, the different QS domain, the second building, was actually tagging video traffic with both 36 and 26. So us going there was fine. Traffic coming back was tagged to 26, and we now thought it was signaling. And we treated it in a different queue. The R is gone. So we treated this differently compared to our outgoing traffic, actually. So it ended up because, well, networking team A was responsible for campus A, and networking team B was responsible for campus B. And they sort of talked to each other, but as long as everything worked and they were never really doing video, and, well, it works, so why do this? And now there was an uptake in video, and now things started breaking down. And even though this was a misconfiguration in the network, well, Link's at fault, right? Because everything was fine, Link came in, and now stuff's broken. So that's some of the stuff that there's some due diligence here when you're implementing Link. Make sure you test the stuff. Just because you've configured something doesn't mean it actually works like that. Just because someone told you it's 36 doesn't mean it's actually 36. which brings us to the beautiful thing of how to do QoS with Link 2013. QoS with Link 2013 is actually quite easy. So with Link 2013, there's no XP anymore, so no more local stuff you have to do. We fully support doing a GPO. So within that GPO, that group policy object, you basically you can use your existing 2010 or 2007 GPOs if you've deployed them. The one difference is we've now actually named our executable instead of communicator, we've actually named it Link. So you might need to change your GPO for that. But basically what your GPO is doing is saying, well, if there's traffic egressing from link.exe on this specific port range, tag it with EF. And that's how we can classify our voice and video traffic. We have a really good white paper on that, enabling QoS for Link 2013, also for 2010, also how to manage this. So these three white papers are really helpful. Once again, the presentations are available for download once I'm done, and you can click on these links, make sure life really easy. The link on the bottom is a blog by Alan Schutnow, and I always mispronounce his name. Is he here right now? No? There we go. Okay. No problem for me. I pronounce his name correctly then. He writes some really good blogs, and one of the blogs he wrote about is how to enable QoS with Link 2013. Nice step-by-step guides. enabling this QoS is the same for both servers and clients. We fully respect the GPO. The thing is, on the server, it's not called link.exe, right? We've got the avmcu.exe, all the different processes. Configured a little bit differently, we will use the GPOs. They're centrally managed, so it's this one-time setup and deploy thing you have to do. Once again, this is explained very well in our documentation and our white papers, the step-by-step guides. And we can tag way more than just a client. If needed, we can tag traffic coming from and to the SIP trunk provider. Maybe your SIP trunk goes over your MPLS cloud. I would really like to have that SIP trunk then tagged with expedited forwarding. IP phones. It's a nice thing. They don't honor GPOs, so we still like to tag them. Internet-based clients, we might want to tag the traffic coming from the edge server back into the corporate network. And, of course, the server-initiated link traffic. So it's actually really easy to validate QoS. That's the one thing that almost no one does. They always implement QoS, and then we're done. If you take something like the Microsoft Network Monitor or Wireshark, whatever's your preference, and you start looking at your packets, you'll actually see that there is a DSP field. Actually, it will actually tell you if this packet is marked or not. In this case, you can see the differentiated services code point is expedited forwarding. So you can see, sure, I've enabled QoS. Does it actually work? And you can also do end-to-end verification. I set up a link call. I'll run a sniff on both my starting and my endpoint. Okay, I tagged my outgoing traffic with EF. When the traffic comes in and has traversed to WAN, is there still an EF tag on it? Did any of my routers now just strip off my EF tag? The default configuration of almost any router is, if there's rogue traffic, strip out the tag. Don't respect it, just strip it. It's one of the ways to find issues like this. So we have a really large worldwide deployment where we found out that, or even though the customer was paying for 3 years for diamond and gold class on their entire WAN, all the routers provided by the service provider were actually configured to strip off any form of DSCP tagging. So, yeah, they've been paying for 3 years, never been used. Oops. We found that. They were very happy with us. Not so happy with the service provider. There's one thing, it's just forgotten. This has been running for 3 years. They thought everything was enabled. It's probably, you'd probably have an oversubscribed network by then, but sure. Trust, but verify. One of the most underestimated roles in the link server, and I'm sure that all my fellow speakers say this about this specific thing that they're talking about, specifically the persistent chat people, I still believe one of the most underestimated roles within Link is the monitoring server. It's a part of the front end now. Just when you're installing Link, you can immediately deploy your monitoring server, and it will give you great report. It will tell you exactly what's going on a, from a network perspective. When Link's running, we do the there's an RTCP stream. So whenever you look at bandwidth, there's always the little add 5 kilobit for RTCP for audio, add 10 kilobits for RTCP and video. This RTCP stream is the way we control our media. It's a real-time control protocol. We use this to make sure if we need to change something or want to exchange statistics about the call, measure packet loss, we do this in the RTCP stream. No, we don't do this in the signaling stream, it's RTCP stream. Beauty of this RTCP stream is it will actually give us detailed results about the call. So we can measure things like a 20.92 packet loss rate. And we report on that from both sides. So it might be that the packet loss rate from A to B was higher than from B to A. Remember that 36-26 mismatch? Something you'd find with this. Average round trip time, average jitter. So we'll report on average values, max values, all in this free, nice little monitoring server. So please deploy them. Please use them. We have great white papers on how to actually use this. There was a session yesterday that you can look back about this monitoring server, how you use this optimally. One of the things that I think Microsoft is still famous for is that we build stuff and then we send it out and we sort of say, well, you can do whatever you like with it, and sometimes documentation might be lacking. It's not for the monitoring server. There's a great white paper on this that actually has all the tables in SQL that we use very well documented. And any form of custom reporting you want to do on this, you're completely free to do this. We have some partners that made great reports on this and really do a deep dive into all these values. Because there's way more information than just this. This is the basic report that we give you. You can go way deeper. this brings us to a controversial point. So, let's do a Q&A, because I've been talking for quite a while now. I still can do my R. What would use more bandwidth? A peer-to-peer video call or a conference multi-video call? So raise your hand if you think it's a peer-to-peer video call. So raise your hand if you think it's a it's a multi-view conference call. You guys are wrong. It's a peer-to-peer video call. It's and I'm not just saying this to prove most people wrong. It's not like it is different every session, right? I have statistics on that. So there are certain things about multi-party video with the standing row, the multiple simultaneous video streams that are misunderstood. I'd like to talk about that for a little bit. So types of network traffic, how does traffic actually flow in Link? We have a new model for bandwidth modeling, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the bandwidth calculator, maybe even show it if we have enough time. So we have 25 minutes left, should be good. So first of all, what kind of traffic do we have? Server, they talk server to server, makes sense. So front end to SQL back end over the LAN, that's fine. We do have WAN traffic in most cases, which would be server to server, but then for data replication, I set up a backup pool. That data has to be transferred between the pools. SIP signaling between the pools. But we also have some user generated. So if no user would log in ever, we'd still have this SIP signaling and this data replication between the pools. But as soon as users actually start using the product, which we'd like, you'd get media content signaling also added to this mix. So let's take a look at this user-generated traffic. Two types of traffic. First, we always think this traffic is significant, right? It's a user. This user is using it. We'd like this traffic to be significant. Well, we know it is, or else the user wouldn't be using it. So what do we call? So we have to make a distinction between: is the traffic actually predictable? Do we think this traffic would? Can we sort of guess when the traffic's happening and how much traffic would be happening, or are we in the are we in the great unknowns right now? So what can we predict? SIP signaling, full presence. We can predict instant messaging. We can take a global average. We know how much instant messages would be sent on average by any person. How much audio calls, how much video calls, both peer-to-peer and multi-party, how much ingress and egress, PSTN calls that would be happening. Some desktop and application sharing, it's fairly predictable, right? We've worked in the past with a lot of customers. We got a lot of user data, and all this user data basically teaches us how much peer-to-peer calls should I expect. How much in every conference call? I should rephrase that. Out of how many conference calls would I expect there to be data sharing? Things like that. And we know this. We can calculate traffic for that. Thing is, so where does it get difficult to predict this traffic? File transfers. We know how many file transfers would be happening at any given point. We can predict that, but we don't know if your company is in the is making a habit of sharing ISO files or just sending a Word doc. PowerPoint sharing. Sure, if it's a static PowerPoint with a few pictures like this, it's fine. But we support a video in PowerPoint. If every PowerPoint I have has a video in it, it's going to use a bit more bandwidth. Attachments. Do people attach stuff to conferences? Maybe a 1 meg PowerPoint? Maybe a 35 meg use manual? We can't really predict that, especially persistent chat communication. It's one of the things you use it or you don't. And once you use it, maybe you're a bank and you use it quite a lot. Maybe you use it just a little bit. We can't really predict that type of traffic. We know it's there. So we take a wild stab at it, which is sort of right, but it always has to be changed for your specific situation. And how can we predict this? Well, we can predict this by, because we know what kind of codecs you would normally use. If it's a peer-to-peer call, it's going to be RT audio. Depending on the network conditions, we would switch from RT audio to any different codec. We would know that if you're in a conference, you'd use G722. We would know if you're in a conference with the link room system, you'd use G722 stereo. And because we know it's the only time where you would use that specific codec, it's very easy to exclude or include. How many link room system calls do you think you'll be having? I don't have a link room system call. Well, easy answer. I don't have a link room system, no calls. Siren, used in backwards compatibility, but also our mobile client, uses Siren by default. So, and G711, of course, for our PSTN calls. So all these things we can incorporate in our traffic prediction. Also, we can use this in our fingerprinting. Well, our vendors can use this in their fingerprinting. So looking at some of the bandwidth profiles, so what we can do, if you're trying to predict the amount of traffic and scale your network for that, we'll give you typical bandwidth numbers. The one thing to be aware of, this is probably poorly translated from Dutch, the law of greater numbers. The bigger your deployment, the more valid these numbers become. If it's, once again, the 5-user deployment, all bets are off. If I'm calculating for 10,000 users, these numbers are pretty spot on. So we can, the one person using a lot of bandwidth will be, he will have his challenger with someone that is using very little bandwidth. It will even out quite nicely. So we provide you typical bandwidth, average bandwidth, for all of these different codecs that you'll be using. And a typical bandwidth is calculated on a 61% speaking time. It's sort of an industry standard. We predict that in every call there will be 61% of you talking, which leaves 39% for you listening, which sort of means that there's still this 11% of the time that both parties would be talking, which is probably something you recognize. I've been told, well, it's not entirely true. If I call my girlfriend, there's like an 80-80% mix where we're both talking like 30% of the time. I don't know how that happens. But it's supposed to be 90-10, 90% her talking and 10% me talking. Doesn't always work out that way. Anyway, I digress. So these typical numbers, they have RCP, they have everything involved. This is the average numbers that we're giving you, and we're telling you, well, use these numbers to calculate for link traffic. We know the scenarios in which they're being used. We know the traffic for those specific, we know the typical bandwidth. So the differences that we have in this table, it's the typical bandwidth, no forward error correction. Upper limit, so what's the maximum bandwidth this codec would be using? So that's 100% talking time, including the overhead, packetization, RTCP, everything. And the upper limit with forward error correction control enabled. And forward error correction kicks in as soon as you have packet loss. It's basically the art of sending packets twice. So this one big beast in the room that we still that no one always asks us about, and we don't always explain properly. So RT audio is a variable codec, it's a dynamic codec, and we can change the packetization time. Which means if we find a network in which we need to change our packetization time, we can. This means that in a normal packet, we would put 20 milliseconds of audio, which is our default packetization time. Which means every packet that now has an overhead of 70 bytes, and we have our audio, which is 72.5 bytes for RT audio wideband, which you could consider a waste of space in our packets because, well, it's almost 50% is overhead and the rest is audio. The big advantage is if this particular packet gets dropped, we only use 20 milliseconds of audio. Drawback, well, quite a lot of overhead, right? 50%. So what we can do if we now actually see if our media stack actually sees this is a very reliable link, but my RTCP control channel is telling me just little bandwidth available, let's change this. So what we'll be doing is adding more audio in the same packet. So we'll change the packetization time. So instead of 20 milliseconds, we'll be using 40 or 60 milliseconds. So you can see in a 60 milliseconds example, you can see that, yes, we've added 40 milliseconds of delay. Once again, I don't really care if my packet, if my delay is really low at that point, and my media stack knows this. I can now have tripled amount of audio in the same packet. Drawback, if I lose this packet, I've lost tripled amount of audio. So that's our packetization time. That's why we report on our packetization time. So if you have a low bandwidth, high packet loss link, and we've actually had to up our packetization time, you're in trouble. You now really do need to do traffic shaping in any form of way. By the way, the packet overhead, as noted, includes all overhead there is, like the SOTP headers, things like that. So what do we consider user-generated traffic from a link perspective? SIP-to-SIG signaling, peer-to-peer audio, multi-party audio, PCN audio, hasn't changed from Link 2010. The values we had for 2010, same for 2013. The only thing we've added is a G722 stereo codec, which is only applicable from a receiving side for most clients, because, well, it's still no stereo mic in my PC, and only if the link room system is sending out audio. So, in general, hasn't really changed. So what has changed? Video. And we did this little hands-up exercise about what uses more. So what's important to see here is that the example we use is the example we really like to show you, right? It's the big thing. You have 5 active video streams coming in. You have your own video. They're all using video. We call this the standing row up top, and we call this the sitting row below. And we have a PowerPoint presentation. This looks beautiful, right? In practice, you'll see, on average, 2 or maybe 3 people having video and 2 people having a picture up there. That's the average that we've measured over all of our deployments, our TAP customers, our own deployment. A lot of people don't enable video. Still, way more people than with 2010. We see a dramatic uptake in video. Still, on an average conference call, 2-3 people will have video. So with Link 2010, we had 3 video resolutions. We had SIF, we had VGA, and we had 720p. That's 3 choices you can pick from. With 2013, we have over 30 different resolutions because we like to choose. And why do we like to choose? Because it makes absolutely no sense in this scenario to send out 5 HD streams. So what do we do? So on average, these streams will be 240p. They will be 16:9. They will be widescreen, but there will be really small video streams coming out. We will scale our video depending on the size of the receiving end. And a normal conference call will either be, when there's no PowerPoint contact, will be PowerPoint or any sharing content will be 5 times 240p. And when there's actually content, it's something like 5 times 108p. I've written it down somewhere here, so we'll take a look at that. And the beauty is, 5 times the sharing video, the 108p, actually uses a lot less bandwidth than that one video you'd get with peer-to-peer. So we have everybody up in arms going, well, you've added multi-party video. That's the first thing customers say, right? We need to disable multi-party video because it's going to bring down my network. It's going to use so much bandwidth. No, not really. It doesn't. Oh, can you prove that? Sure I can. Take a look at that. So first, how does video work? So a peer-to-peer, Alice to Bob. We'll do a call. It's H.264 SVC. It's a scalable video coding platform, which means that we don't have to do any muxing on our front-end server. That's why we don't need the AVMC, the separate audio-video pool. It's all co-located on the front-end because the only thing we do is drop frames. That's the beauty of SVC. We can just send out different resolutions from the client based on the PC capabilities. And the only thing we have to do on the AVMC is drop frames, get it to a lower frame rate if needed. So Alice to Bob, they could do a 4:3 or 16:9 video. It's straight to each other, A to B, front end just does signaling, and that's it. We can do a sub-SIF up to 1080p. You can even do on a ARM tablet. You could do 1080p. It's H.264 SVC, which means hardware acceleration on most platforms. So beautiful video, 4 Mbit. And we always talk about 4,010 kbps because we have to add the 10 kbps for RTCP. So yes, this can be very bandwidth intensive, but the number we use, 4 Mbit, is the maximum bandwidth for full HD video. So the more you move, the more you have colorful shirts and colorful backgrounds. The more you do stuff like that, the more bandwidth you'll use. On average, it's about 2.1 Mbit that you'll be using in a full HD video. So moving from there, what if she would actually be using a pre-Link 2013 client? We would switch to RT video. Simple as that. We are now using the 3 RT video resolutions, sending from Bob to Alice and back. So what about the multi-video? This is where the AVMCU comes in. So everyone is sending the video to the AV MCU, and the AV MCU now distributes this back to the clients. Important thing to note, if you're doing the multi-party view, so you can see that here, these are square, but they're actually sent out in 16:9 resolution. The one thing that's really cool, and I urge you all to try this, do a video call, make sure your video is on, and then have someone else step into the video. So you had this video where one person was in, now the second person goes in, that video will actually go to a widescreen video, and it will now show two people. Link has this face detection mechanism in it, so it will actually widen your tile if there are more than one people in there. I think that's pretty cool. So if you ever feel bored, you can do a video call, a conference call, and test this out and see how the tile becomes a widescreen and then gets back to a tile if that person's gone. That's why we need to send them out in 16:9, and that's why if you move a little bit during the call, you can see the tile following you. So I'll send out my video stream. Video stream gets sent to the clients. Each person sends out their own video stream, and their own video stream gets sent back to those clients. The thing to note, so in if you do a conference call, normally it'll be up to five 240p tiles. As soon as content's added, so it's 180p. That we'll be using at that point. It's just a screen estate, right? And the video size we're sending out is the video size that's requested by the client. So if everybody's in this default mode using 240p video sizes, every client will request a 240p video stream from the other side. So you can see these are all the same, so branch 2 and branch 3 will both be requesting a 240p video from branch site 1. As soon as branch site 3 now decides to zoom in on that specific person in branch site 1, the RTCP stream will actually tell branch site 2, I don't need video from you anymore, which doesn't impact the video stream in this case, because branch 2 will still send video to branch site 1. But it will actually send a signal through the AV MCU to branch site 1 and tell them, well, I know you're sending 240p. Could you please send me 1080p as well? Because I'd like to see you in 1080p. That's how video works in Link. Depending on the requester, we'll send up to 5 different video streams from a sender. Which sounds like a really scary scenario, because everybody could be this bandwidth cloud of death, where everybody's requested different 1080p screen from someone else, and everybody's now sending 240p, 180p, 720p, 1080p, all these different sizes. We've never seen that happen. And we have a lot of statistics. It makes no sense. It just doesn't happen. And this one time it happens, you can control this using call admission control. It is simulcast. It is not. It's simulcast, but it's not multicast. You have to be aware. It always goes through the AV MCU, and the AV MCU sets up multiple video streams to multiple people. It's not a multicast action. We've talked about the SVC codec. It's temporal scalability. I just call it dropping frames. It is actually temporal scalability. Where you can tell, well, the branch site now says, well, I don't have as much bandwidth available. Please only send me 15 frames a second instead of 30 frames a second. The AV MCU can now drop frames and send a smaller video stream. Let's go there. So these are this is actually the proof in the pudding. What we've seen on average peer-to-peer call, 18% of the peer-to-peer calls would be around 200 kilobits. That's probably the sweet spot for a video call. By default, 424 by 240. Some people go to 640 by 360, which is the resolution you'd get if you would just press full screen on the client itself, so you'll still have the IM window, and you'll get this your own video, and you'll get the other video. And you really have to go to a full screen video if you want to see 1080p. This is average sent received, so that means that an average video call will consume approximately 200 kilobits. So as soon as we go into the conference calls, you see actually that an average video call, most video calls used around 40 to 70 kilobits. And some of them used up to 200. But you can see, if you look at these values for peer-to-peer, and you look back at the conference calls, you can really see over the 200 kilobits, almost no one does this. And the reason why almost no one does this, no one can. You can't fit 5 1080p streams on your one single screen. You need a really big screen for that. So that's the one concept you have to keep in mind. We only send the video screen sizes that are requested by the other clients. And we honor the screen estate for that. And we've documented this thoroughly on TechNet. So you'll see, actually, it's not a mistake, it's the truth. The sizes for incoming, for conference video, the bandwidth usage is actually lower than the usage of peer-to-peer video. All this data, is, by the way, is coming from all of our TAP deployments, our internal deployments. We keep monitoring this. We have a lot of customers that are giving us these nice values and are helping us. Which means we've also updated our bandwidth calculator. Who has ever used this bandwidth calculator? A few people. So the one thing I'm going to tell you, if you're, and once again, kbullens@microsoft.com for all your hate mail. If you're doing a link deployment over a WAN and you haven't used the bandwidth calculator, you're doing it wrong. It's a very firm statement, but it's the only statement I can give you. If you're having quality issues, it's because you haven't used this bandwidth calculator. The guy that built this thing, Mr. Ostrovsky, he's my direct colleague, and that guy is a scary genius when it comes to bandwidth numbers. So whenever I need a number, I just call him, I tell him, well, I'm doing a peer-to-peer call, it's this very specific resolution. He's like, oh, it's that many kilobits. Oh, don't forget the RTP stream, it's going to be this big, and oh, if you're going to do this, this, and this, I'm like, dude, I got my number, I'm fine, it's good. The amount of work in this bandwidth calculator to get all the numbers right, to get this vetted by the product group, it's enormous. This can be considered a live work. I think if he would just hand this to our managing director and then tell him, I'm going to retire because this is done, I don't even think he would disapprove that. Please use this. There is a Word document attached. So you see a demo. I've got 1.5 minutes, and you can come up to me after this and ask me all the questions you'd like. So there is a Word document attached to that, which actually helps you go through this bandwidth calculator. So how to use this, what do the different values mean, because there are a lot of values in there, how to use this effectively. So we guide you through the calculator. And once you start using this calculator, it will tell you anything you need to know. It will tell you, you can define all of the sites you have, your central sites, which have link pools, your branch sites, whether they have PSTN breakouts or not, whether they have direct connections into your central site, whether they could always use G711, RT Audio Narrowband. It's all question-based. There is no in-depth knowledge of how Link uses the video streams required, all the different streams. I would highly recommend using knowing that. But if you go through the document, you'll get a pretty good estimation. It's always an estimation. You get a pretty good estimation of how much bandwidth usage should you expect. And this bandwidth usage will be very detailed. So it will tell you exactly, there we go, how much bandwidth should I expect to be there for over my WAN, my peak WAN, my peak video, my peak audio, my peak inter-site traffic. And I can apply any traffic model to this. So I can tell them, well, I've got really high users. Sorry, that's a bad word to use, I guess. I've got people that use Link a lot of video. For instance, in the Nordics, we have a lot of video usage. For the south you go, less video usage. And you can compensate for that in this calculator. So if there's one takeaway from this session, use this calculator, go home. When you're in the plane, you can download this. Have fun. It's good to, well, before getting a good nap. So take a look at this. It will most definitely help you during your deployments. Which means that, you see, when the timer is zero, I have to stop, right? I think the last slides only told me session takeaways, have a better understanding of networking QoS, so I hope I sort of did that. Talk a little bit about the link bandwidth usage. How does link usage bandwidth? Why? What are average traffic numbers that you could expect? And I hope this better prepares you for any of the networking conversations you might have in the future. Once again, this presentation is available for download, so you have some resources you can download. You have my email address. Once again, open for all hate mail or questions. and some related content. I think we've had the other sessions already. I'm supposed to be at the booth at 1:45. I'll probably go there now. So if you have any additional questions, if we get kicked out of the room, then come to the link booth. We're in a tech expo. It's the thing that's conspicuously marked link. And I'll be hiding somewhere there. You can ask me any question you'd like. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. And I hope you have a great rest of TechEd.